You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a researcher explains the ways that an ongoing trauma like the pandemic can change the way that our brains perceive time. Now, according to a 2020 report from the Federal Communications Commission, nearly 27% of Wisconsinites in rural areas of the state don't have access to at least one broadband internet service. Governor Tony Evers has about $200 million set aside in his proposed budget for the next biennium for funding broadband. Republicans in the state legislature have proposed broadband spending in various amounts. And President Joe Biden proposed spending $100 billion nationwide on connecting Americans to high-speed internet. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How is the internet where you live? Fast enough? Too slow? Is it affordable? Has it changed in the last year? Have you gone from 0 to 60 lately? What do you think needs to happen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. That money I just mentioned is only proposed, but if and when some money does become available, how could it get used? Brittany Beyer is executive director of the Grow North Regional Economic Development Corporation. She's also chair of the governor's task force on broadband access for Wisconsin. Brittany, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So that number about just over one in four residents in the state not having those options for broadband in rural areas. How big a problem do you see that being in those communities?
Well, I think this last year told us a lot about how important broadband really is and has been for quite a while. It is a problem. It's a problem for education. It's a problem and a barrier for running businesses. And telemedicine is becoming the way of the future. So there's just so much that it needs to be done to make sure there's access to everyone.
And you work on economic development in particular. Can you talk about broadband access as an economic development issue, especially for smaller rural towns?
Sure. Grow North is almost 100% rural in the eight counties that I represent. One story I talk about a lot, in one of the counties, a business wanted to do just regular equipment upgrades, and they were willing to put millions of dollars towards this. They had a really great conversation with the provider of that equipment. They got to the conversation where they said, okay, now you have to have constant contact so that we can ping in 24/7. And they said, we have no internet. And they were gobsmacked. So that company wanted to investigate putting up their own tower, which was super expensive. There were just so many of these barriers and hurdles to even just doing regular equipment upgrades. So honestly, I am very, very reticent to talk about Industry 4.0 in my area. And clearly that puts us at a 21st century divide if we want to all be competitive.
Can you talk about the challenges of, you know, if I'm a company and I want to put the money into putting in internet and I've got thousands and thousands of customers in this small area, great. I know I'm going to make money going a couple miles to reach that the one road there with two, three houses on it, less of a good investment. Can you talk about that challenge?
Right. So, you know, we hear very often that, the industry has built out where they definitely can see the return on their investment. And the truth is, to do the future-proof building, which is fiber optic by design, right? That is a very expensive proposition. You have to do digging. The equipment is very expensive in of itself. And then there has to be that return on investment. In rural communities, there doesn't necessarily seem to be that return. And that's where we really need to be cognizant that we need public-private partnerships to make that happen, and it's not an easy process, and that's why it hasn't been done yet. But clearly, this is an issue that is not only inside of the state of Wisconsin; it's a federal issue, and that's why as we're looking at this vast bill from the federal level pushing us into the 21st century, this is squarely inside of how we're going to move forward.
There's a bunch of different numbers bouncing around there about investment, right, from the federal infrastructure package, from the governor, from state lawmakers. We don't need to get bogged down in the detail because who knows what it's going to end up being. But the scale of the numbers you're seeing from those different parties, does it seem like people are talking about putting enough money in to get what we need?
Well, with all of the money flowing in, it's going to start getting us in the right direction. I can't even tell you how expensive it would really be to do the infrastructure across the whole entire country. I've heard the number floating in just billions of dollars just to solve our problems, right, in the state of Wisconsin. So we want to do as best as we can with all of those resources that are flowing. Now, working with federal and state level grants, that can be a confusing task. And I'm hoping we can take this time right before the guidance starts to flow down to really buckle down and get to the place where we understand who's getting ready, who needs what, and start that type of almost triage work before this inflow of new ways of solving our problems. We've been talking at the task force about that issue, where it's almost, a way we've never seen resources moving before. And we want to make sure that we have the ability to get past some of the hurdles that might be coming, including, making sure that we have enough workers who are trained to do this massive expansion of infrastructure work, making sure that our supply chain stays really solvent as we're moving so quickly. I think those are some of the things that we're having in the background conversations. And I think as we're waiting for guidance from all of these different programs to flow, that's what we're trying to think about.
Talking to Brittany Beyer, Executive Director of the Grow North Regional Economic Development Corporation and Chair of the Governor's Task Force on Broadband Access for Wisconsin, looking at possible big injections of money from the federal and state levels into expanding broadband service, especially into rural areas. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Heather starts us off in Madison. Heather, hello.
Hi, I'm actually a local elected official from a very small rural town, and we've been talking about this for a long time. We've been talking about putting in our own fiber optic cable. We have a sidewalk plan for our village, and we said, well, if we're going to dig up the sidewalks anyway, why don't we just run conduit and run our own fiber underneath there? And then we can partner with somebody else to come out. I think that we as a society need to view high-speed internet as a utility, that is an American right to have high-speed internet. The entire country of South Korea has been wired for fiber optic cable for over 20 years. And I understand that there's a huge scale difference between us and South Korea, but the reality of the situation is if we want to compete in the 21st century and beyond, we have to do what's necessary to invest in our country, in the infrastructure, to make us competitive, or we might as well just kiss it goodbye. And that means doing it and stop talking about it and start doing it. I hate to sound like Ross Perot, but that's, I think, where we're at. And I agree we need public-private partnerships, but I will also say this, that access to high-speed internet is too expensive. And partially that's because, yes, there's an upfront cost, but they are gouging people. Let's be realistic about it.
Heather, thanks a lot for the call. Heather gives us a lot to work with, Brittany. Let's start with that last point. And I think President Biden, in announcing the broadband plans, made this point as well, that Americans, even when they can get high-speed internet, pay more for it than, say, somebody in Europe or I think South Korea.
Right. And one of the very interesting points inside of that bill is that if you are going to be running your company over these newly built broadband infrastructures, you have to be allocating, resources to make sure that the cost is more effective. And absolutely, it's something that we really understand, and the affordability as being part of the problem. We've been working on that at the task force as well. And because it's an area that hasn't had that much conversation, there's been this anecdotal understanding of the issue, and it's become so compressed because of COVID that we know that everyone needs this access. We know that it's, for a lot of people, way too expensive. How do we make this affordable? And Heather may had a really great point about, a municipality just saying, okay, we're going to run our fiber and we're going to talk to different providers and say, hey, do you want to lease this out? And I think that's part of a great way of solving it, where the municipality recognizes their role. There's a place for the providers to come to the table. And then when you are working in rural communities, you've got a number of different issues that you have to tackle. And so we're trying to make sure that we understand the issue in all of these different angles, but absolutely a great call.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Brittany Beyer from the Grow North Regional Economic Development Corporation, looking at some of the challenges of expanding broadband internet access in rural parts of Wisconsin and how potential federal and state dollars, all proposed at least, could help. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you encounter a full phone line. You could also email ideas@wpr.org with your questions, your thoughts, and your experiences. We'll continue the conversation. Take more of your calls coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now about what state and federal money could be used for to expand access to high-speed internet in rural parts of Wisconsin. Brittany Beyer stays with us, Executive Director of the Grow North Regional Economic Development Corporation and Chair of the Governor's Task Force on Broadband Access for Wisconsin. We'll go back to your calls now with Andrew in River Falls. Andrew, hi.
Hi. So I'm one of these people that can't get internet. I'm not particularly rural. I actually live just across the river from Minneapolis-St. Paul on the Wisconsin side. And I want to express how difficult it is to live without internet in today's day and age. You can't get a job. You can't participate in a lot of pop culture. You can't pay your bills sometimes. Combined with that, in this part of the state, our part of the community, you really don't have much for cell phone service either. So it's kind of a double whammy. You can't get cell phone. You can't get internet. You can't get TV. It's really like living at this point almost 20 years in the past.
Yeah, Andrew, I wanted to ask, you mentioned getting a job. Like, what do you do when you are trying to apply for a job or apply to get a vaccine, say? So much of that's online these days. What do you have to do to scramble?
You can go to the library, which during the age of COVID has been impossible. I tend to do all my business before work. If I'm sitting in my car after work, sitting in my car, my wife will go to her friend's house or to the grocery store to bum off their internet signal. So we spend a lot of time in our cars doing internet work from our phones.
Andrew, thank you so much for sharing that. Brittany, I mean, obviously a big obstacle there, but I've also heard that, you know, it's not rural area in the middle of nowhere necessarily we're talking about. I've heard this in the past too, people living 20 miles from Twin Cities, Madison, Milwaukee, saying they're in the same boat as some rural area, full-on rural areas.
Right. And I was so surprised to learn that as well. I live in the North Woods. You kind of know that you're going to hit those pockets. But when you hear the stories that are that close to these more urban centers, and you think that it's not going to be a problem, then you have to go, well, why is that the problem? And start to put in the pieces to solve that problem. It has to be, there has to be channels for people like Andrew, who he's not the only one. His family is not in an isolated case. They have to be able to go to a channel and have that addressed and become part of a larger mapping and understanding who's really underserved and have some plans to build out to these places. So what's really interesting is it probably is a fiber line that needs to be run for 800 yards. And because the cost is such that nobody's really taken it on, it hasn't happened. And so we need to be able to start really investigating some of these end user problems and start to find out how to solve them.
Thanks a lot for that call. Andrew, we'll go next to Dave on the line in Silver Lake. Dave, hi.
Hi there. I might lose you because so bad out here.
We got you for now, though, Dave. Go for it.
I'm in Silver Lake. I'm only about 20 minutes from Kenosha, and we have two providers. We have, I think, Frontier or Time Warner Spectrum, and both are outrageously priced. And I coming from Chicago, like I'm from Chicago, so honestly, I didn't think that it would be that an issue when you look on the map and you're like, wow, I'm pretty close to a pretty major metropolitan area, and to get just nothing from when you're calling these people, when you're calling these companies and saying like, the service is terrible. Even the cell phone service is, there's black spots, there's like dead spots everywhere. I just don't understand why it could be like when you're in a Wisconsin, Illinois area like this. I just don't really understand it.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Brittany, what do you think?
He's not alone in feeling like that. And it's a conundrum because it feels like we want some leadership to solve this issue. And really, I really think this is a moment of active participation at a local level. So if you live in an area where you're in a small, you know, in a village or a town, really just say, hey, is somebody at the town, village, county level paying attention to broadband? Are you guys taking a look at this? If they are, they should be looking at kind of a plan and an overlapping way of looking at where the coverage is and where there are some trouble spots, and then start working with providers. Now, we are talking with the PSC and the task force because the maps that we have available through the FCC are not as granular as we need to solve some of these problems. And that's one of the issues that we're trying to solve. But it really means that there needs to be a light foot put up at the local municipal level, at the Heather level from the first caller, to be part of creating the solutions, because otherwise we're going to continue having conversations like this.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Brittany Beyer, Executive Director of the Grow North Regional Economic Development Corporation, Chair of the Governor's Task Force on Broadband Access for Wisconsin, looking at the needs for broadband access, especially in rural parts of the state, but as we're hearing, not just full-on rural parts of the state, and the impact of possible state and federal money maybe in the pipeline. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234 with Randy in Madison. Randy, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Great topic. And my question was basically, you know, it seems like given the impact of this resource and also perhaps given the recent crisis related to the Texas isolation from federal involvement in power, perhaps I might have some concern about private-public partnership, and maybe this should be something that's federal. Something akin to, you know, the interstate system, and because everyone should have this, and it just seems like relying on localities, you know, in terms of funding and regulation might pose a problem, but wondering about comment on that.
Randy, thanks for the call. So maybe a more standard federal-based regulation across the country instead of a patchwork system, Brittany.
Sure. I'll try to answer this as quickly as possible because it's pretty complex.
Yeah.
But Randy's right. He's pointing to language like utility. But I would say that he's right that, and you're right, that it would be done at the federal level. That would be the FCC. Not really confident that that's going to happen, that they're going to name it a utility. However, I can easily say that our infrastructure is not built out. And that's why this is in that large jobs bill that is all about infrastructure. We do need to think about the infrastructure in a better way. And in the absence of having that federal level of oversight, that's what the task force is thinking about. How are we going to make sure that somebody has their eye on the prize at the state level, with understanding how, you know, there's regional nuances inside of our system. There are communities that are more ready to jump on the bandwagon and talk to a provider and get things done. There are, you know, we're looking at Taylor County, who is going through the bonding process and working with a provider to build out what's called a middle mile loop out there. And they'll be in public-private partnership over there. And that might be a way that they solve that. we are going to have this patchwork way of working because that is the condition that we are in. But we have so many opportunities to put in the collaborations and the communication and structuring things and staffing properly to get this corrected.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Sig next in Northwestern Wisconsin. Sig, hello.
Hey. I just had a question for the panel there. Has anyone discussed Starlink, the Musk project? And if so or if not, I guess I've known one person that received that dish, I guess, if you will, and been using it. And it's certainly a pretty legitimate alternative to fiber.
Sig, I'll jump in. We just have a few moments left, but that's that Starlink, that low Earth, I think, orbiting satellites as an alternative to wires. Is that something you've had your eye on, Brittany?
Of course. And there's pilot projects happening here. I would say because Starlink is being built out rapidly through a federal program on the west side of the country, they're going to hit this crazy explosion of users. So we have to wait and make sure that the technology is going to, like, the speed is going to stay up. And with anything satellite, there's this concept of latency that we're watching as well. So if it takes a while to go up, it takes a while to go down. They're low orbiting, but we're still making sure that that's going to be something where people can actually use it.
Yeah, as I understand it, in general, the fiber optic is going to be more reliable and better and
correct,
faster than anything that goes into the air. Is that the state of the art just about?
That's the way that we're thinking. There are going to be, we're kind of thinking about it being technology agnostic, because there are going to be places that are going to have to do something like Starlink. But let's build out the fiber as far as we can and give people choice. And that could potentially drive prices down as well.
We'll leave it there. Brittany, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Brittany Beyer is Executive Director of the Grow North Regional Economic Development Corporation and Chair of the Governor's Task Force on Broadband Access for Wisconsin. We talked to her about state and federal money and current proposals could be used in the effort to expand rural broadband access here in the state. Coming up, if before the pandemic feels like a really long time ago, you're not alone. A guest tells us why the last year has distorted the sense of time for a lot of us. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. In just a few minutes, a researcher joins us to tell us about her findings on how the pandemic has distorted the way that we experience time. But first, state and federal health officials are hoping most people will want the COVID-19 vaccine, but they know some won't. And that could determine whether Wisconsin, and the rest of the world for that matter, is able to end the pandemic. Shemaine Mills has more.
As the state begins to roll out a public education campaign to get more people vaccinated against COVID-19, it's approaching a turning point in the pandemic where vaccine supply could soon outstrip demand. Until now, Wisconsin's had just the opposite problem. Demand has been high. However, supply was sometimes uncertain, and health officials repeatedly urged people who wanted a shot to be patient. State health officials have pegged July 4th as the time when 80% of Wisconsinites could be vaccinated if the state's vaccine supply from the federal government remains steady and people remain eager to be vaccinated. The first to get immunized are what Department of Health Services Deputy Secretary Julie Willems-Van Dyke calls early adopters. So far, just over 20% of people in the state are fully vaccinated.
I think it's going to be a little bit harder once we get over 50 to 60%. We may need to encourage a lot of people to get vaccines, so it may take a little bit more time.
Where they live may play a role in how receptive people are to that message. In January, polling from the Kaiser Family Foundation found that rural Americans were most likely to be hesitant to get vaccinated. Amanda Marsh lives in rural Brown County on 10 acres with her husband and their 5 children. The backyard is near a wetland, which is busy with blackbirds and geese this time of year. While she's not ruling out a change of heart, the 39-year-old Marsh said no one in the family plans on getting vaccinated against COVID-19.
I don't know that taking something that does not have long-term studies on it is the right decision for me. I honestly would probably have a lot of anxiety if I was to take it.
Health experts say the vast majority of side effects that happen with any vaccine occur in the first 3 months, and there's no reason to believe these vaccines are going to be any different. The vaccines have been tested on tens of thousands of people in clinical trials, millions have been inoculated, and complications have been rare, says Dr. Pat Remington, a UW-Madison professor who used to work for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Well, it's understandable that people are concerned about long-term health effects of the vaccine because it hasn't been around a long time. But if there were considerable risks down the road, we would already be seeing those.
State and national efforts to encourage people to get vaccinated will include sports figures, clergy, and word of mouth, focusing on both rural and urban areas. On Monday, the Brewers announced players were vaccinated over the weekend. And Ben Weston, Director of Medical Services for Milwaukee County, says everyday people can be part of the effort too.
And after you've received your vaccine, be the ambassadors to your community. Reach out to your friends, to your neighbors, to your family. Let them know why you chose to be vaccinated.
Amanda Marsh doesn't think she'll be convinced. She has relatives who work as nurses and says some have gotten the vaccine, others have not. Same goes for her friends. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has advised everyone to get vaccinated as soon as they're eligible. Medical professionals say this is the way to not only protect yourself, but others. How that message is presented is key. Marsh wants people to be educated, not shamed.
I think implying that people don't care if they don't get vaccinated about everybody else is just blows my mind, because that is not where I stand. And I want nothing bad to happen to you. I just have to do what's best for me.
But medical experts say the odds are against those who choose not to get vaccinated for COVID-19, a disease where the risk of death and long-term medical complications exceeds what might happen if someone gets a vaccine designed to prevent that. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, can you tell the difference sometimes after a year of quarantine? Some people can't. So one scientist coined a new term, Blursday. That's the one long, exceptionally bad day that's lasted a year or so. If you're struggling to understand the past year, if you can't think more than a few days into the future, you're not alone. Our next guest studies the way that traumas like 9/11 change our brain's perception of time. She says the pandemic is an ongoing trauma that can inhibit our ability to understand the past and imagine the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has living in a pandemic for over a year changed the way you perceive time? Does the year 2019 feel like ancient history to you at this point? Is it hard to think back at what that time scale has been, or you know, what a few days out, a month out from now could look like? Call 800-642-1234. Or has your daily routine been changed in a way that kind of disrupts your flow of time? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Allison Holman is a professor at the University of California, Irvine, Sue and Bill Gross School of Nursing. She studies how trauma impacts cognitive and emotional processes, including the way we perceive time. She's lead author of the paper, The Unfolding COVID-19 Pandemic, a probability-based nationally representative study of mental health in the United States. Allison, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I think a lot of people may be familiar with the kind of murky time zone we've been in for a while, but this basic idea that a trauma can affect the way our brain perceives time. How does that work?
It's a great question. It's a great question. So when people experience a major event like a trauma, what happens is you're forced into the moment of having to cope with that, right? You have to think fast. You have to deal with the event that's confronting you. And so oftentimes the usual sense of continuity from the past, which is what gives us our who we are, to the present and then into the future, which is where we imagine ourselves going, that kind of drops off. The future drops away. The past kind of drops away, and you're focused on that present moment in a very intensive way. And that's a good coping thing to do in the moment, you know, because you need to address the trauma. But at the same time, if that persists over time, if that persists as things pass on, you can end up having problems where you end up being what we call being stuck in the past and whatnot. With COVID, it's been a little bit different in that what happened was when the COVID pandemic hit, it was such an ambiguous. It's so unsure. There's so much uncertainty about what the future is going to look like when the pandemic first started in the States, that we ended up not really knowing what the future was. It's kind of future just kind of got chopped off, and for a lot of people, and that has very negative consequences mental health.
For a point of contrast, an event like 9/11, which would really, you know, people experienced it or watched it from here in the Midwest over the course really of one awful day. What do we know? We've had a lot of time, I think, to digest that. What do we know about how that event, maybe at a large scale, affected our perception of time and the way we deal with time?
Well, we did see in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, I did see that people were experiencing some of the same kinds of symptoms of what I call that process called temporal disintegration, where your past and present and future kind of get disconnected from one another. And we did see that was associated with having poor mental health outcomes over time. And we're studying that now in COVID. And hopefully we will be able to present some findings in the near future that talk about the role of time perception in COVID. What's unique about COVID is that the COVID pandemic is itself an ongoing event. Unlike 9/11, it kind of rolled on. Not only did it roll on, but it rolled into many other major collective events. Massive unemployment. People were experiencing people dying, people getting sick, people going to the hospital, then there was major civil unrest. There was a very contentious election that took place in the same year. All of these things rolled up to create this sense of cascading traumas. And people were struggling. And so it wasn't just one event. It was multiple events that kept keeping people away from thinking about where my future is going and getting back on track with where my normal life was going. And so I think that has had a very significant impact on people's sense of time.
On top of all that, Allison, something that a lot of people have been talking about is how their daily routines have been disrupted. Kids are learning at home, many of them, instead of going to school or working from home or out and out losing a job. So many of the things we build our daily routines around were disrupted. Does that add a layer on top of all of that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we're used to getting up in the morning and having a routine that we follow, right? That's pre-pandemic. That's what many people had, some routine of you get up in the morning, you get dressed, you go to work, or you get up in the morning, you get dressed, you take care of your kids, you get up in the morning, whatever. Those things came to a screeching halt or a major shift, like a 180 degree shift. And when those things change like that, it can really change your outlook on the world. And again, what I was saying is the future became very unclear. You know, tremendous ambiguity about what would happen in the future. And that's very anxiety provoking for people. And the uncertainty of not knowing what the future brings is very anxiety provoking for people. So yes, all of those other things were disruptive and created a very different sense of one's life. Also, many people were staying home, you know, a portion of our population, not the essential workers, but a portion of our population was now working from home and having their entire routine quarantined in their home. which is a very different routine, right? And the questions were coming up about whether you're going to go back to your normal routine. And so that and all of that creates just a very different sense of the world you're living in and disrupts your sense of time. So we see people doing things like, some people felt like time stopped. Some people felt like time had slowed down. Some people felt like time had sped up. Some people felt that time had both slowed down and sped up. It's a really interesting sense of distortion that gets created by these kinds of changes. And the Blur's Day thing, the Blur's Day comes from becoming, you know, when you're not in your routine and you're staying in the same place over and over, doing kind of the same thing over and over in the same place, it kind of gets hard to distinguish between days. And so people were having a hard time knowing, what day is it? Where am I? You know, and it was very disorienting for people.
We're talking to Allison Holman, professor at the University of California, Irvine School of Nursing, about her research on time and trauma, how the pandemic has changed our perception of time. Has that happened to you? Call in at 800-642-1234. Has time slowed down, sped up, a little of both for you? Has it blurred together? Has the disruption of daily routine affected you? Call 800-642-1234. A couple examples from WPR staff. Larry Mueller Show producer Jill Nato says, time has sped up. Weeks go by in the blink of an eye. I think it's working from home and less time at social occasions, events that tend to mark time. Susanna Michaels from our fundraising team says her problem is she doesn't have enough of it. She doesn't know how she used to squeeze in her commute and weekly Sundays of childcare for a grandchild, but she's filled it up, making sure she gets a walk an hour a day to keep her mental health up and that sort of thing. Colleen Leahy, WPR producer, says, I'm not really able to think about the future anymore. When I try to, it makes me feel stressed. So a lot of different ways people are reacting. How about you at 800-642-1234? We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Allison Holman, nursing professor at the University of California, Irvine, who spent years studying how trauma impacts our perception of time. We're talking about time during the pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234 to tell us how the pandemic maybe disrupted your daily time routine or your big picture sense of the past and the future. We got an email from Meg, Allison, that I want to share. She says she started drinking midday to cope with the collective pain of the pandemic, but she writes, now I'm sober and have been allowing myself to heal through dance, visual art, and writing. The release of pressures of time have given me freedom to create and start projects and goals I may never have before. At age 36, I'm finally finishing my BA in psychology, which I thought would take too much time. Learning to be okay with the present moment and adapt to uncertainty has been a precious gift. And that takes me to the question I wanted to ask you, Allison. If we're thinking about this and noting our changed relationship with time, and we realize it's making us feel bad, are there things we can do about it?
Absolutely. One of the important things I would suggest is, the discussion about people losing their sense of their future is critical. I think it's important for people to try to rebuild a sense of future, even if you can't, you're not vaccinated yet, or if you're in a position where you can't go out and rebuild your life the way it was. Trying to create for yourself a sense of a future by setting even short-term goals that are very achievable. So sticking with very manageable, short-term, reasonably approached goals that can accomplish, and then working toward those goals. So it might be tomorrow, it might be, if you can, a couple days from now, or if you can, a week from now, that's your goal. Work, you know, plan yourself to work toward those goals to help yourself recreate a sense of future and having a sense of control over your own life. And that's a part of what happens when the future is kind of like gone. It creates that anxiety, but it also creates a sense of not having much control. And I think it helps to, if you take those small steps to make sure that you do have a goal and you're working toward it and you are in charge of that and focusing on that. If I may, the comment in the email was very interesting, because there are some people who feel like they have more time now than ever, and they're making good use of that extra time. And that's another way that the temporal the change in being forced into being into the present more for some people has been a blessing, has been a gift. And but it's so not everybody experiences these time changes in exactly the same way. I just want to make that clear.
I want to bring on a caller now. Samara is with us in Oshkosh. Samara, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking the call.
What did you want to tell us about, Samara?
Sure. I wanted to share that going through COVID reminds me a lot of my childhood. I grew up in Lebanon, in the country of Lebanon, during the Civil War there. My family lived there from 1976 to 1983. And although I didn't have the fear for my safety, it's that inability to plan for the future and know what's coming next that in the first couple months of COVID, I was really tapping into skills I built up as a kid I didn't realize I was going to need to use again as an adult.
So what can you share some of those skills with us, Samara?
I think it's being able to take pleasure in little things that are around you and really focus on the home scene, getting one thing that happened for us is really getting to know our neighbors a lot better. And growing up, we knew our neighbors really, really well because there were times during the war where your neighbors are really your only resource for being able to get water or sharing just different places that were needed. And also being just really hopeful, building those small mile markers of success and hope, as opposed to looking at the big picture of doom, but seeing the little things like spring came and the flowers opened. And these are markers, sort of those logical markers are really.
Oh, you're breaking up, Samara, but wow, thank you so much for sharing your story and your lessons there with us. Allison, what do you think?
I think it's a beautiful description of some of the changes that you can experience in the context of trauma in terms of your time perception. Thank you. Yes, as I mentioned, you become more focused on the present moment. And what Samara was describing was being able to notice the things in the present that brought joy. And that's a wonderful thing to be able to do. Oftentimes when we're focusing on going into our future in the normal, you know, in our usual routine, we don't pay attention to what's in our present. So by being brought into the present and having to stay there more for longer, it can, if you choose to find it, make you see some of the more positive things. The other point I want to bring up is that oftentimes people who are in war zones or places where there's a lot of strife and violence, that's actually a common time, a common situation in which we see people losing that sense of the future. And the future can be gone. And for adolescents, it's particularly challenging and can actually be, it has been associated with greater rates of depression and other mental health problems in young people who are in that situation. And what Samara described about bonding with neighbors and bonding with people very close, that's one of the best coping strategies in a situation like that, is to create those kinds of bonds that you can turn to and you know, keep you having a sense of normalcy in your life. So it was a beautiful example.
Definitely. In just our last minute or so, Allison, how can we, I don't know, check ourselves and our relationship with time and realize that we need to watch those spring flowers are opening and call that neighbor, even if we have to do it from a safe distance?
Yeah, well, I would just encourage people to consciously contemplate where they've, you know, who they are. That's part of what your past is, right? Your past gives you who you are. You know, pay attention to where you are in your present moment. But also, as I said, start to think about how you can slowly rebuild your future. In small steps, very small steps, and know that you can. You just need to do it very consciously and create that so you have that sense of continuity between your past, your present, and your future. And of course, to the degree that you can take advantage of seeing in the present moment, having that greater present focus where you recognize the good things around you, I think it would be very beneficial for mental health and well-being.
Allison, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. A wonderful opportunity.
That was Allison Holman, professor at the University of California, Irvine School of Nursing. She joined us for a look at how the pandemic has changed our perception of time and ways to help our mental health by realizing it and making those connections with the world around us and the people around us. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Monday at 8, are you overwhelmed by clutter in your home or your workplace or home/workplace? Help is on the way. A Wisconsin expert on organization and decluttering shares advice and answers your questions. That's Monday at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then Governor Tony Evers joins the show. We'll talk to him about vaccine efforts in the state and his plan for billions in federal stimulus money and relief money coming to Wisconsin. Plus, it's Friday. That means there are some new recipes up at WPR.org/Food Friday for advanced meal preparation. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.